Usually when you look at a map, you just see the finished product of a city.
Right, the final draft.
Yeah, like the highways are already poured, the skyscrapers are already reflecting the sun, the stadiums are packed. You tend to think of cities as these static, engineered grids that were just drawn up on a whiteboard somewhere.
It feels like a master plan. Like someone just decided, hey, put a hospital here, put a stadium there, and zone this area for residential. But when you trace the actual history of a place, that illusion of a master plan just completely vanishes. You're basically looking at a landscape built entirely on accidents.
Accidents, pivots, and honestly, downright failures. And today, we are looking at exactly what happens when you let that messy, organic evolution run its course for 150 years.
It is a fascinating process.
It really is. We have a great stack of source material today. It's a collection of articles from the September 2026 edition of Arlington Today magazine.
Which is a special issue, right?
Yeah, because Arlington, Texas is celebrating its 150th anniversary. And our mission for this deep dive is to explore the anatomy of a thriving community, specifically through the lens of this one city. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
We are looking at a century and a half of history, trying to figure out how a tiny, like 500-person farming town transforms into this bustling epicenter of health, sports, and culture.
What's fascinating here is that to really understand that anatomy, we have to look past the basic timeline of local events.
Right, we need the why.
Exactly. We need to look at the causality. How does one seemingly random, disastrous event lay the bedrock for massive future growth? We really want to spot the patterns between a town's history, the psychology of its entrepreneurs, and the culture it eventually builds.
Well, we are starting right at the literal foundation of the city. Because before a city can boast about world-class health care or massive sports stadiums, it needs resources.
Basic survival stuff.
Yeah, specifically, it needs water to survive. But this city's story starts with a water source that is hilariously bad.
It is a spectacular failure of municipal planning.
For sure. So we are in the early 1890s. Arlington is basically just a few cotton gins, a railroad stop, and some dirt roads. And a local merchant named R.W. Collins decides the town needs a public water well.
Which makes sense.
Right, so they raise the funds, they pick the most prominent intersection in town, Main and Center Streets, and they drill this well in 1892. But when the water finally comes up, it smells strongly of rotten eggs.
Oh, gross.
And it tastes absolutely awful. In fact, it was so bad that they tried to give it to the horses and livestock, and the animals flat out refused to drink it.
I mean, picture the scene. You've spent all this community money. You've used a heavy steam engine to drill right in the middle of town. Everyone is watching, and the water is completely undrinkable.
Total disaster.
Yeah, a modern town would immediately cap it and probably fire whoever chose the spot.
Wait, so the animals flat out rejected it, but the humans saw the white powder residue left behind when the water dried in the dirt streets and decided, hey, this must be a miracle cure.
So that's exactly what happened.
It's like digging for a septic tank, hitting raw sewage, and convincing people you just found a gold mine.
Well, you have to look at the historical context of the late 19th century. This was the golden age of elixirs, snake oil, and the concept of taking the waters. People were inherently suspicious of modern medicine at the time, which was still quite primitive and, frankly, often painful. So they leaned heavily into natural, mineral-based remedies.
Ah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So when they realized this water was heavily mineralized, which explained the terrible taste and sulfur smell, they didn't cap it. They rebranded a municipal failure into a medical miracle.
And they leaned in hard. Dr. J.D. Collins opens the Arlington Sanitarium right there on Center Street. They actually pipe this awful tasting water directly into the facility to treat everything from indigestion to rheumatism.
And they didn't stop at just making people drink it.
No, they started boiling the well water down in these massive vats until it evaporated into a concentrated powder they called Arlington crystals.
It was essentially their local, highly marketed version of Epsom salts. They packaged it up, shipped it across the entire Southwest, and people were drinking it diluted or bathing in it for their skin and digestion. Think about the economic ripple effect of that one pivot. This accidental, terrible tasting well birthed a whole local economy. It put Arlington on the map as a health destination.
They even built a decorative fountain for it around 1910, complete with these iconic lion heads spouting the water.
But eventually, the modern world caught up.
Yeah, by 1951, post-World War II, traffic was booming, and having a giant municipal well right in the middle of the main downtown intersection was a massive traffic hazard.
I can imagine.
Cars were literally crashing into it, so they finally capped it.
But, capping the well didn't erase its impact on the city's DNA. That well shaped the town's identity for nearly 60 years. It was the gathering place where news was traded, where commerce really started.
And you can still see that DNA everywhere today. You've got the Mineral Well Public Plaza that was just dedicated a few years ago in 2023. There's a replica fountain at Vandergrift Town Center. The original horse trough is sitting over at a local heritage park. And the local library literally has a preserved section of the original well structure on display.
It's everywhere.
Oh, and those lion heads from the 1910 fountain. They are now the official logo used to define the entire downtown Arlington district. Plus, Arlington's sister city is Bad Königshofen in Germany, which happens to be a famous mineral springs spa town.
It just proves that a city's identity is often forged by how it responds to its earliest challenges. And that ethos of audacious community building, basically taking big swings with natural resources, it continued.
Oh, absolutely. Jump to 1954. The city desperately needs a larger water supply for the booming post-war population. Mayor Tom Vandergriff pushes this massive, expensive project to build Lake Arlington.
And people were not happy at first.
No, critics loudly called it Vandergriff's folly, claiming it was too big, too ambitious, and would take years to fill if it ever did. But nature had other plans.
Didn't it fill up incredibly fast?
Yeah, it rained so heavily that the massive lake filled to capacity in just 28 days. They immediately started calling it the Miracle Lake.
That transition from the Mineral Well to the Miracle Lake illustrates a profound bedrock of civic duty. The willingness of local leaders to take massive reputational risks for the future of the community.
Right.
The magazine highlights this deep-rooted civic foundation by profiling families like the Cravens, who have been civic leaders in Arlington since the 1880s, steering the town through education, law, and banking.
Were individuals like Louis R. Rocco too?
Exactly. He went from being a troubled local teenager to earning the Medal of Honor in Vietnam and then dedicating the rest of his life to saving local veterans.
It really makes you think about your own hometown. What are the accidental landmarks, the weird town quirks or the controversial follies that actually laid the groundwork for the local economy you have today?
Right. Because they go from hawking foul-smelling street water as a miracle cure in the early 1900s to today, where that same foundational pursuit of wellness has evolved into something heavily backed by hard science.
The evolution is wild.
If you look at a place like the Viridian Community, you see the modern iteration of this health economy.
Yeah, the magazine profiles these modern medical entrepreneurs, and the standout operation is this facility housing two distinct medical practices operating under one roof, Revik Medical and the Alan Saad Institute.
They are essentially bringing coastal-level, hyper-specialized medical expertise right into the heart of North Texas.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. They've built this holistic ecosystem. It's like taking your car to a garage where one genius mechanic handles all the software and engine diagnostics, and an elite auto body specialist handles the physical structural repairs.
That is a great analogy.
They are totally separate businesses, but they are working in tandem on the same complex machine to get it running perfectly.
And taking that mechanic analogy a step further, the beauty for the patient is they don't have to drive to two different garages. Amy Haddad leads Revik Medical, which focuses entirely on functional, non-surgical care.
So no scalpels over there.
Exactly. She's not cutting you open. She is looking at the chemical messengers in your body. We're talking about finding the root cause of an issue rather than just treating symptoms.
So looking at hormones, metabolism, gut health.
And peptide therapy for both men and women.
Right. And for those of us who aren't doctors, peptide therapy is basically using short chains of amino acids to signal your cells to perform specific functions, like healing tissue or balancing hormones. She is essentially reprogramming the body's software.
And then, literally across the hall, you have Dr. Red Allensaad running the Allensaad Institute. His focus is exclusively on female surgical care.
The structural side.
Right, pelvic reconstruction, repairing severe birth trauma, things that absolutely require a structural surgical solution. He's a former Air Force surgeon who helped write the defining textbook on female cosmetic genital surgery.
Oh, wow.
But more importantly, he's a prolific inventor.
The article mentions he holds patents for tools that are used by doctors all over the world, things like Thermiva, the Lone Star Vaginal Retractor, and Allenson Scissors.
Yeah.
And he even created a streaming e-learning platform called Gynflix to teach his specific cosmetic gynecology techniques globally.
To understand why those patents matter, consider the Lone Star Retractor. In delicate reconstructive surgery, a surgeon needs a perfectly clear, stable field of vision without causing unnecessary tissue trauma.
Makes sense.
By inventing tools that optimize that environment, he is literally shaping how other surgeons operate globally. Furthermore, he performs the majority of his procedures in office, using only local anesthesia.
Which means no IV, no general anesthesia, and none of that awful grogginess where you lose an entire day just waking up.
Exactly. Think about what this means for you or anyone living in a community like this. 10 years ago, if you needed this level of specialized urogynecology or advanced regenerative medicine, you were booking a flight to a massive university hospital in Dallas or flying out to Laguna Beach, California.
Right. It was a whole ordeal.
Now it's embedded directly into the local community. It completely changes the standard of living for a city when world-class expertise is just a 5-minute drive down the road.
And I noticed a lot of these local clinics are pushing boundaries. For example, Urology Partners of North Texas, or UPNT, has Dr. Patrick Cullaney running actual clinical trials for recurrent UTIs right there in the community.
Which is a huge deal.
Isn't that incredibly difficult to pull off? Usually you only see clinical research at major academic institutions. How do you convince local patients they aren't just guinea pigs?
Overcoming that psychological hurdle is absolutely the hardest part of localized research. UPNT has to actively work to assure patients that participating in research isn't a gamble.
They have to build that trust.
Exactly. They have to rigorously explain the safety protocols, the strict monitoring, and the underlying reality that clinical research is the only way medicine actually advances to find better alternatives. When a community clinic successfully runs trials, it signals a massive lead in institutional trust.
The magazine also highlights Women's Health Services, which is the largest all-female OBGYN practice in Tarrant County.
Right, adding to that robust medical ecosystem.
And you also have entrepreneurs like Brenda Cureton-Smith at Great Skin Spa and Facial Club. She started by bringing the first U.S. franchise of a Canadian cosmetics company called Faces to the local mall.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, she ran it for 5 years, and when the parent company made that unsustainable, she didn't quit. She pivoted and launched her own independent spa. She's been running it for 15 years now.
That's real staying power.
It is. She talks about helping clients find their internal smile, basically connecting outward skincare directly to inner self-esteem and confidence.
All of these entrepreneurs represent a community that has matured. Arlington is no longer just surviving its frontier days, it is optimizing its citizens. And once a community reaches that level of health, stability, and longevity, it naturally seeks out shared experiences.
It needs to play.
Exactly, it needs to play.
So how does a city evolve its entertainment from its agricultural roots? If you look at the sports timeline in Arlington, the scaling is just wild.
It really is.
In 1933, they legalized wagering, and Arlington Downs horse racing drew an average of about 6,700 spectators. Fast forward to 1972, the Texas Rangers play their first Major League Baseball game in North Texas at Arlington Stadium in front of about 20,000 fans.
That big jump.
Huge. Then jump to 1995, and they host the MLB All-Star Game at the ballpark in Arlington, drawing over 50,000 fans.
It's a masterclass in how a city scales its appetite for spectacle, moving from regional curiosities to massive, nationally televised prestige events.
But wait, the magazine highlights an event coming to Globe Life Field this September 25th through 27th.
Cool.
The Savannah Bananas bringing Banana Ball.
All right.
And they are bringing along the Texas Tailgaters, who do synchronized line dancing and parking lot grilling as part of the actual game experience.
This is quite the production.
So what does this all mean? Have we devolved here? Have we moved from serious prestige sports like the 1937 Texas Derby, which was literally seen as a proving ground for the Kentucky Derby, into a literal circus?
Well, I get why you'd ask that. It is easy to look at line dancing baseball players and dismiss it as a circus. But this raises a fundamental question about what community engagement actually looks like in the modern era.
Okay, how so?
This isn't a devolution at all. Banana Ball is a masterclass in hyper-interactive community building. Traditional prestige sports can sometimes feel incredibly passive. You know, you sit in a plastic chair, you eat a hot dog, you watch millionaires play far away on a field.
Right, you are just a consumer of the product.
Exactly. But modern audiences, especially coming out of the isolation of the last few years, are craving deeply joyful participatory experiences.
They want to be involved.
The line dancing, the constant fan interaction, the breaking of the fourth wall. It's about dissolving the barrier between the spectacle and the community. You aren't just watching the game. You are part of the chaotic joy of the event.
It's less about the final score on the board and more about the shared experience of the city.
And massive corporate entities recognize the value of that specific energy. It is not a coincidence that Six Flags Entertainment Corporation announced they are moving their corporate headquarters back to Arlington in 2027.
Oh, right. Locating it right at Choctaw Stadium.
They want their executive leadership embedded directly in that vibrant, interactive, participatory environment.
And that vibrant pulse isn't just restricted to the massive stadiums either. The article lists this whole calendar of events that make up the texture of the city.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah. You've got the 5th annual Downtown Arlington Classic Car Show on September 26th at the Vandergrift Town Center, where they are expecting 240 classic cars, with proceeds benefiting the Police Foundation.
That's a huge turnout.
And you've got Pumpkin Nights at Howell Farms running from mid-September through Halloween, featuring an immersive path with over 7,500 hand-carved pumpkins.
Why does a city invest time and space for 7,500 hand-carved pumpkins or shut down streets for classic cars? Because when you transition from a survival economy to a thriving economy, civic leaders realize that shared aesthetic experiences are what actually keeps citizens rooted in a community.
And visually, the city is heavily investing in that aesthetic. They are rolling out 16 new public art pieces in 2026. Things like a giant Texan golden boot and this intricate glass sundial called Touched by Time for Founders Plaza.
It's a conscious choice.
Yeah, it's a city actively choosing to make its public spaces beautiful rather than just functional.
But, you know, as vibrant as the festivals, the public art, and the baseball games are, we have to look deeper.
What do you mean?
Those are ultimately the visible, surface-level celebrations of a city. If you want to look at the actual future of a community where the next 150 years will be forged, you have to look at a much quieter, far more complex system. The public schools.
Ah, right. The magazine actually covers the Arlington ISD convocation at UT Arlington's as College Park Center.
A massive event.
It was this huge pep rally style event for thousands of school district employees to kick off the new year. The new superintendent, Dr. Matt Smith, led the event under the theme Making Dreams Happen.
That's a great theme.
Yeah, they had high school choirs, student orchestras, dancers, local businesses even rallied together to give away 6 free cruises to employees.
Which is just a beautiful burst of optimism. The beginning of a school year is like the beginning of a sports season.
Yeah.
Everyone is undefeated and the potential feels limitless.
Totally.
But we have to balance the energy of that pep rally with the grounded, often harsh reality of the educational system. The author of the article notes the massive elephants in the room that educators are facing the moment they leave that arena.
It's definitely not all just cruises and choirs.
Far from it. Public schools everywhere, including here, are facing intense systemic pressures. You have steadily declining enrollment numbers.
Yeah.
You have intense academic scrutiny focused heavily on standardized test scores. You have seasoned teachers leaving the profession due to burnout. And, crucially, you have the looming pressure of state oversight if a district falls short of arbitrary metrics.
The article uses an incredibly sharp analogy for that oversight. They say a state takeover of a local school district is like having your mother-in-law decide your house is a mess, so she moves in, rearranges all your furniture, micromanages your cooking, and absolutely refuses to leave.
That is a terrifyingly relatable analogy for anyone who has ever hosted in-laws.
Right.
It perfectly captures the profound anxiety surrounding education right now. You lose your autonomy.
The writer of the article spoke to a local parent, identified simply as Fuller, who captures this tension perfectly. She talked about the dread that comes from knowing how quickly the shiny hope of a new school year can fade into bureaucratic reality.
What did she say?
She said, "You just want the best for your kids, but sometimes no matter how hard you try, the system is what dictates what happens to them." And then she sighed and said, "I'm just going to roll with it."
I'm just going to roll with it. You know, that quote is profoundly resonant. It captures the raw reality of being a parent today. It is the ultimate defense mechanism against an overwhelming system.
You have these massive administrative bureaucracies, right?
Yeah.
Superintendents focusing on 5-year strategic plans, state accountability ratings, unfunded mandates, and endless budget acronyms.
That's exhausting.
And then you have the parents on the ground making lunches, just hoping that this massive educational machine remembers that there is an individual grieving child underneath all that paperwork.
The true test of a city's resilience isn't just in how quickly it builds stadiums or how advanced its hospitals are. It is in how it bridges the gap between those cold bureaucratic systems and the everyday citizens navigating them.
Yeah.
Parents like Fuller are the ones quietly securing the future of the city, one day, one homework assignment, one chaotic school drop-off at a time, even when the deck feels entirely stacked against them.
Looking back at the incredible 150-year arc we've covered in these sources today, it really proves the point we started with. A city truly is a living, breathing organism.
It really is.
It doesn't start with a master plan. It starts with an accidental, terrible-tasting mineral well. It grows through the bold, root-cause innovations of medical entrepreneurs like Dr. Alan Saad and Amy Haddad.
It finds joy and celebrates its culture with line-dancing baseball teams and massive pumpkin festivals.
Yes, and it quietly secures its future through the hopeful, fiercely resilient parents who wake up every single day to navigate the school system.
As we conclude this analysis, consider your own life or your own community's history. What is your mineral well? What is that one thing you initially viewed as a complete failure, a mistake, or an absolute disaster that actually laid the hidden foundation for your greatest long-term success?
A reminder that sometimes the worst-tasting water is exactly what you need to build an empire. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the anatomy of a city. We hope it gave you a new lens to view the messy, beautiful evolution of your own hometown. Keep exploring, stay curious, and we will catch you next time.